Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Since I've lost 6 minutes of show to the news headlines, I've got to decide between my own commentaries and interview time. Today I'm going with interview. Maybe some comments next week. Two segments today. First, in less than a minute, Yiannis Varoufakis will tell us about the new Greek government and the continued unraveling of the Eurozone. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Amber Hollibaugh and Kenyon Farrow, two contributors to the New Queer Agenda, a special issue of The Scholar and Feminist Online, as Behind the News' contribution to Pride Week. Okay, Yiannis Varoufakis. Yiannis has been a professor of economics at the University of Athens. As life in Greece became more difficult, he took a job with Valve Software, a Seattle-based gaming company organized in anarcho-syndicalist principles. We'll hear more all about that in a few weeks. But now, here's Yiannis Varoufakis on the Euromess.
It looks like Greece is on the verge of forming a government. What does that look like?
It will be a government with a single task to allow Europe to claim a great victory in perpetuating an agreement that was signed some time ago between the European Union, the International Monetary Fund, and the Greek government, which everybody knows cannot be implemented, which is founded on predictions and economic data, which is obsolete, but which nevertheless seems to be quite important, in particular for Germany, in its bargaining with primarily Spain and Italy, because any renegotiation, any recasting of the Greek bailout loan terms and conditions would put the spanner in the works in the German maintenance of steadfast denial regarding what is going on in Spain and in Italy. You have a government in Athens, the purpose of which is to continue with the implosion of the Greek social economy for the benefit of the powers that be in Berlin and in Frankfurt in their own personal, political and economic struggle regarding the megaliths of Spain and Italy that are collapsing.
And now, remind the listeners, just what is Greece expected to do under this agreement and why it's impossible?
Well, firstly, it's supposed to rein in the budget deficit at a time when the Greek social economy is shrinking at minus 7 to minus 9%. In other words, it's expected to perform a miracle that has never been performed before in economic history, based on assumptions which are at least by 50% off, given the recent track of events.
The election results. The election was won by people who are nonetheless pledged to this agreement, but they're under some expectation to nonetheless renegotiate it to some degree?
There were two major propositions that were being put to the Greek people last Sunday. Both of them claimed that a renegotiation was on the cards, and both of them were programs that promised the Greek people that Greece would be staying within the Eurozone. The difference between those two programmatic declarations of the two major parties that contested the election, the Conservatives and the Radical Left Party, was that the Radical Left Party was arguing that unless we are prepared to consider the possibility that we will say no to the terms and conditions that are being offered to us, simply because they're not workable, unless we're prepared to say no, then we're not talking about a negotiation at all. We're talking about a petition. We're going to be simply asking for things, hoping we'll get something. And I believe that they're completely spot on. Whereas what the Conservative Party is arguing is, we'll go to our European friends and we'll say we have a fresh mandate. Please give us something better. Now, I don't believe for a moment that that can be described as a negotiation. It's, as I said, it's more of a petition.
Tell us some about Syriza. It's a coalition of a number of parties that have been around for a while, but it's a coalition that's relatively new. Who are they, and what do you think their position towards the agreement really was?
Syriza has its roots in the Spring Prague of the 1960s, because it was the rolling tanks of the Soviets in the Czechoslovak capital that caused the Greek Communist Party to split. Syriza's roots are to be found in the Eurocommunist splinter, following that particular split, that tried to adapt communist ideology to a European template. They were very pro-European, from the very beginning in the 1970s, they were in favor of the European Union, and they have been consistently since then trying to find a narrative that is consistent with the idea of a Europe of its peoples, as opposed to Europe, a Europe of its banks and capitalists. The reason why I'm saying this is because Syriza is being portrayed in the international media as profoundly and constitutionally anti-European. This is completely at odds with its past. Now, that Eurocommunist party was the main pillar that brought about Syriza. Syriza, by the way, means coalition of radical left. It was always a party that teetered on the verge of not making it into parliament. In Greek parliament, you need 3% in order to enter parliament. And they were always there, between 2.5% and 4.5%. And in a bid to solidify their support so as to ensure that they would be in parliament, there was an attempt to broaden their appeal by bringing in strands from different movements, feminism, ecology, a kind of rainbow coalition. So it is a very diverse coalition. The main point is that this was a traditionally pro-European party from the beginning. So their position was never anti-European. Their position was not even against membership of the euro. What they're saying is the current policy is driving the whole of the eurozone to the wall, and somebody has to say no to this policy, which is just madness in action, and which surreptitiously is leading Greece out of the eurozone, and therefore to the collapse of the eurozone.
Syriza wanted to keep alive the possibility of default, right?
Well, default is going to happen. It happened once in March. It was a default. I mean, in Europe, we're very good at euphemisms, so they found an acronym by which to call it. They call it the PSI, Private Sector Involvement, which is just utterly Orwellian. So we had a default, and the unique characteristic of our Greek default in March was that because it was done the way it was done, this is the very first example I know of a country that has defaulted, and yet, after the default, the next day after the default, it still had a debt overhang, which was unsustainable, therefore foreshadowing the next default.
The dominant parties are going to form a government that is going to attempt to do something that's impossible. What next?
I think that what's going to happen is that come the end of June, when the new Greek government attends the European Union summit, there is going to be a reward for them. They have fended off the terrible radical left people, and they will be rewarded with some goodies by the Troika, by the European Union, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. These goodies, these rewards, will come in the form of a loosening up of the terms and conditions of the Greek bailout loan agreement, possibly a small reduction in interest rates. I wouldn't be surprised if there was even more money thrown at the Greek state. And all that is going to be portrayed by the new government upon its return from Brussels as a triumph and as a great piece of evidence that the Greek people chose wisely. Alas, it's all going to be wasted, because we've had prolongations and reductions in interest rate and so on and so forth before. This whole approach is predicated on the false assumption that the medicine is correct. It's just that the dosage was a bit too hefty and it needs to be reduced. The medicine is not correct. The medicine is poisonous. And by prolonging and loosening up the terms and conditions of the Greek bailout, the agonizing death of the Greek social economy is still guaranteed. It's simply going to drag on further. And the terrible thing about this is that in order to give all these goodies and rewards to the new incoming government, the German people will be misled yet again. They will be told that this is another example of German solidarity towards the suffering Greeks, even though it's no such thing. The German taxpayers will be told that they will have to pay more for it, which is true. They will have to pay more for it. And then when October, November, December, it's clear that those new looser terms and conditions are not working, then at some point something will snap in Germany. The German public will say no more solidarity. It's killing us. It's not doing much good to them. So social capital within Europe will have been expended. People do believe that this is a form of solidarity, but it isn't any such thing, because let's not forget that none of those loans are being utilized in order to energize the Greek economy and help the Greek people. These loans are used by the Greek government in order to repay our creditors and to keep, in other words, the pretense that the default can be averted forever when it can't. About 3 weeks ago, the Greek state borrowed something like 4.2 billion euros from one arm of the European Union, from the EFSF, the bailout fund, to give it to another, to the European Central Bank. Not one penny went to the coffers of the Greek state. Cancer patients can't get their chemotherapy drugs, and yet this is being portrayed as an act of solidarity towards Greece. It is true that the Germans are paying for that 4.2 billion, but no Greek is ever benefiting from it.
Who are Greece's creditors?
For 2 years, what happened was, the official sector, as it's called, in other words, the European Central Bank, the European Union, and the International Monetary Fund, have stepped in with many tens of billions of euros and have paid off the private creditors of the Greek state, primarily the French and the German banks. In other words, they took the Greek debt onto their shoulders. So the potential losses of the French and German banks were shifted to the primarily German and Dutch and Finnish and Austrian taxpayers. Very similar to what happened in the United States. You know, banking losses become the liabilities of taxpayers. Now, it's interesting that it's French and German banks, primarily German banks, that are being bailed out by the German taxpayers, but this is presented as a bailout for Greece, which is nice and curious, isn't it? Now, this has been completed now. They got what they were going to get from the German taxpayers, and they are quite happy because they got most of it. And what they didn't get from the Greek, from the German taxpayer, they got from the European Central Bank in the form of QE, quantitative easing, of huge liquidity from the European Central Bank. So German bankers and French bankers are quite happy. The worries that they had about the Greek debt, which was outstanding, have been lessened. Now, all this rubbish is on the shoulders of the sovereigns, of the taxpayers, of the surplus countries in Europe, and this is why the German people are protesting, even though they have been misled into thinking that they helped the Greeks, when in the end all they did was to bail out their own banks. So the first default was a haircut that represented a small cost to the private sector, to the French and German banks. That was March. The next default is going to be a haircut for the German taxpayer.
I'm speaking with Yanis Varoufakis, who joins us from Athens. Greece is being held up as an example to your larger cousins to your west, right? They're also trying to make a point to Spain and Italy. What's happening with them? What are the prospects for the bigger countries who could be far more disruptive?
The awful truth is that the German game plan seems to have crashed and burned. The reason for imposing upon Greece what I call fiscal waterboarding, that was never going to work in the sense that this kind of severe belt tightening in Greece would never reduce the deficits or do anything in order to repay the debts of the Greek state or to reform it. And I think that Germans knew that. But it was a way of deterring Italy and Spain from thinking that it too could exit the money markets if they were forced to exit the money markets and effectively borrow from Germany. So they were being told, look, if the worst comes to the worst, we come to the rescue of our fellow European Eurozone countries, but the cost is so great of appealing to us in that way that you are better off using your own ways and means in order to pull yourself together. Effectively, it was a workhouse strategy. Just like the English workhouse in the 19th century was a place in which life was so nasty, brutish, and short that no poor person ever wanted to enter the workhouse, the European bailout fund, the EFSF, was the modern-day equivalent of that workhouse. Now, the reason why I'm saying that the German strategy has completely failed, well, Spain is now bankrupt, and Spain is, cap in hand, entering the workhouse of the EFSF. So the deterrent utility of Greece is no longer there. So you hear voices in Frankfurt, especially in the financial sector of Europe, of Germany, that Greece should now be chucked out of the Eurozone because its utility has simply waned. But what these dangerous fools do not realize is that the systemic risks of chucking Greece out of the Eurozone are such and so vast and great that the Eurozone is going to end up shifting its borders from Spain and the Mediterranean to the Rhine and to the Alps.
And where does France fit into that?
France is damned and condemned by this process. Once Italy explodes, and it will in the next 2 or 3 weeks, because already we have in Italy the kind of bank run and asset stripping that we had in Spain a few months ago, then the contagion is going to go straight to France. France is a deficit country. Its own fiscal position is extremely precarious, and it has no capacity to maintain the Paris-Berlin nexus, given that it won't be in a position to do anything different to what is happening now in Italy and in Spain.
To paraphrase Freud, what does Germany want? It would seem that German interests would be served over the longer term by showing a little bit more mercy, by being a little less austere, and spreading a little of the money around in order to sustain the euro and the broader project of European unity. But Germany is not. Germany is being hardlined and apparently inflexible. Can you read the German mind? What is the German government and its elite trying to do?
To be fair to Germany. Germany is paying a very large amount of money for keeping the Eurozone together. It's not that it's not costing Germany money now. Germany is putting up most of the funding for these bailout funds. Germany is swallowing the bitter pill of allowing the European Central Bank to provide more than $1 trillion of liquidity. You know, for the Germans to have this kind of money printing is anathema. So, but the question is not how can Germany be convinced to spend a bit more money. It's institutional. The question is how can they be convinced to unify the banking sectors of Europe and to allow for the demise of the notion of a Spanish bank or an Italian bank. You know, just like in the United States, you don't have a Texan bank and a Californian bank. You just have banks under the FDIC and so on and so forth. Germany is loath to Europeanize the banking system. Germany is loath to allow for a degree of integration of public debts across the Eurozone. And the reason why Germany is loath to do that is because I think, and this is my answer to direct answer to your question, what's in their mind? They want to preserve the euro, but at the same time, they want to preserve their exit option. Germany being a surplus country, even though it doesn't want to get out of the euro, it has the capacity to get out of the euro and to exit the euro with costs, significant costs, but still intact, not to go to pieces. Whereas if a country like France or Italy or Greece declare they're leaving the Eurozone, the capital flight from those countries will be such that they will be reduced to the Stone Age very quickly. So that exit option that Germany has and which the others do not have gives the Chancellor of Germany an enormous amount of bargaining power in European Union Council meetings. And it's my considered opinion that the German Chancellor thinks that she doesn't have the moral authority to diminish the office of Chancellor to such an extent by Europeanizing banking, by Europeanizing debt. Because Europeanizing means that effectively Germany will no longer be able to leave the Eurozone in precisely the same way that California cannot leave the dollar zone. So it's a strategic issue. And unfortunately, the problem that Germany is facing, and it becomes Europe's problem, is that they are the only ones who have the power to change the architectural design of the Eurozone and therefore save the euro. But they will lose that power, or at least they will lose their bargaining power within this organization, within this currency union, if they use it.
But it looks like the whole thing is going to blow up if we continue on the current path. Is there any way to avoid that kind of explosion?
Well, it won't be the very first time that the German elite, caught up in its own idiosyncratic assessment of its interest, has brought its nation down and with it the whole of Europe. They seem to be going in that direction. They seem to have been completely caught up in the trap of their own mindsets making. I do not see any kind of ray of light and hope from the direction of Frankfurt or Berlin. in this regard. There are certainly things they could do. As I said, they could unify the banks, and they could unify part of the debt, and they could allow an investment-led recovery program to take effect in Europe and bring us out of this collective and hideous recession. After all, let's not forget that Germany was the beneficiary and did grow to become a strong and powerful economy as a result of exactly that kind of attitude and action by the United States in the late 1940s and 1950s. But I see no signs of intellectual life in Germany that give me hope that their thinking is converging into that fruitful direction.
Is this an issue of like national character and national worldview, or there are some deep material interests that seek to maintain this this threat of exit and this the German power through the threat of exit over the rest of its European partners?
As always, it's a combination of the two. There are very clear material interests, not of the country as a whole, but of those who are closer to the powers that be in Berlin. And they coalesce beautifully, in inverted commas beautifully, with a mindset which is not helpful in throwing light at the nature of the crisis. So let me be very specific here, very precise. German banks are just as insolvent as the rest of the Eurozone banks, and they know it. They won't admit to it, but they know it. Deutsche Bank, Finanzbank, they are in a terrible, terrible mess. At the moment, they're doing pretty well because of the capital flight from the periphery of the Eurozone, from Greece, from Spain, from Italy. All this money is flowing into their banks, but it's not ameliorating their insolvency. They have lots of assets on their books which are worth nothing, and yet if they are written down, then suddenly those banks become insolvent. So they know that. So their number one worry, they do not want a serious investigation into the state of their own books. So they don't want a banking union. They do not want to be supervised by the ECB. They want to be supervised by their friendly local politicians. And their friendly local politicians do not want to spoil the broth for their friendly local bankers, because it is the friendly local bankers which are bankrolling their pre-election campaign and their politicking. So you have a very nice little cozy relationship between politicians and local bankers, which is standing in the way of a rational attitude towards what is necessary in order to promote effectively German interests. That those are the material incentives, the material explanation of German recalcitrance. Now, moving to the mindset, it is true that the United States of America is responsible for all this. And it's responsible for all this because the U.S., from 1947 onwards, took it upon itself to allow Germany to behave as if it was a shiny factory, a workshop that was producing beautiful stuff, cars, machines, electrical goods, technologies, without having to worry about the source of demand for those beautiful products. Why? Because the United States, from 1947 to 2008, in one way or another, managed to generate the aggregate demand that would allow the German workshop to sell its beautiful wares. So Germany was allowed to keep thinking in terms of a shopkeeper or a workshop keeper, that if, as long as they produced good things and they were working hard and they were diligent, there was no problem in that. The tragedy, of course, is that following the crash of 2008, the one thing that's missing in the world economy is demand, and the United States of America is not capable of generating it anymore after the debacle of 2008. And after that, this kind of vacuum in global terms, Germany is refusing to acknowledge that its power must now become hegemonic, and that they must, and what is the, what does it mean to become hegemonic? It means that just like the United States from the end of the Second World War until recently was minding the global shop in terms of generating sources of aggregate demand for Japan, for Germany, for everyone, for American companies, that Germany will have to do the same thing at least within Europe. That is, not only worry about how to produce good stuff as inexpensively as possible and at the highest quality, but also managing from a macroeconomic point of view the aggregate demand that is necessary in order to be able to sell those things. So this is the mindset problem. And if you put it together with the material interest of German bankers, you have today's penchant for dithering.
That was Yanis Varoufakis, once at the University of Athens Economics Department, now economist in residence at Valve Software in Seattle. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break to talk about the new queer agenda. Some of a weird 2010 song by Killing Joke, the European superstate. Next, we'll talk with Amber Hollibaugh, co-director of Queerists for Economic Justice, and Kenyon Farrow, former executive director of that organization. Both are contributors to the New Queer Agenda, an issue of the Scholar and Feminist Online. You can find it by Googling New Queer Agenda. Welcome, both of you. To steal a phrase from the 1920s ad men, what is the unique selling proposition of your point of view? How is it different from the mainstream gay agenda?
Well, that's an amazing question to start with, Doug. We can just jump right in. Kenyon, you want to start?
Yeah, I'll take a stab at that. I think that our position differs from the mainstream LGBT movement, not just in form, but in actual essence, right? So when we look at the kind of issues and the actual kind of strategy of the mainstream LGBT movement over the last, 15, 20 years in particular, what we've really seen is the gay liberation movement of the late 60s, through the 80s really become co-opted and taken over by a much more center-right, kind of agenda that has privileged the kinds of issues that impact white upper class gays and lesbians above everyone else. And has spent, in the probably hundreds of millions of dollars at this point, kind of legislative advocacy campaign, around marriage equality, don't ask, don't tell, and hate crime legislation, those three in particular. And actually, as we speak right now, the, Employee Non-Discrimination Act is being debated in Congress, and people from various organizations are giving testimony. And those really sort of four make up the kind of agenda of the mainstream LGBT movement. And I think what myself and Amber and a lot of the other kind of organizations, the communities we represent, have argued that those issues, even once won, do not equate to equality or certainly not liberation for a vast majority of poor and working class LGBT folks and particularly folks of color in the U.S.
Amber, do you want to add anything to that? Or?
I think what I would add to that, Doug, is that political agendas are created to represent the movement that is articulating those values. And if the movement that you either are a part of or want to create has a kind of perspective of joining in with America as it's now assembled, as it's now structured, rather than trying to dissemble something really problematic in the way that America functions, that the United States functions as a country, then your agendas are going to be different. You're going to want to be included. I think for a lot of folks in the New Queer Agenda book and around the organization QEJ, we have a much different perspective, which is that poverty is not an acceptable thing. That's not just a side issue. That poor queer people live out lesbian, gay, bisexual, and gender nonconforming identities in very different ways, precisely because of the way that their queer identities intersect with poverty, with race, with class, and that those can't be not the priority. So I think we ask a different set of questions about what it is that's important and where you start. And if you start in low-income, poor, and communities of color, when you're talking about LGBT liberation, you ask a different set of questions and you have a different set of priorities.
How did a movement that traces origins to a lot of the liberation movements in the 60s end up putting marriage so central to the agenda?
Well, right.
Just a moment to laugh. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a lot of it actually had to do with AIDS and the politics of AIDS, so that, unfortunately, when the AIDS crisis is really first recognized, you know, in the United States in the world in 1981, and it surfaces largely in, you know, white gay men, and it surfaces, you know, at the sort of apex of the neoconservative era, right? The, you know, Ronald Reagan's election, you know, is seen by many people as, you know, the kind of first neoconservative president, and there had already been a growing backlash against many of the kinds of wins that a lot of the left movements, you know, had been making in the 1970s. So backlash against the civil rights movement, against feminist movements, and against the gay liberation movement. So you have this infectious disease that arrives that's targeting, you know, gay men in this context where the culture is going consistently sort of more hostile to that community already. And I think that what happened is that there were a number of people in the community, I think, who really believed on some level that perhaps we had, as a community, been too decadent in terms of our culture and sex lives and what have you, and you know, there were the debates of, you know, in the community about closing the bathhouses and so on and so forth early in the epidemic. And so it's at that moment that a number of kind of wealthy white gay men who would have never otherwise been active in any kind of activist movement become active because them and their friends are dying of AIDS. And that in and of itself, and all of the kind of money and resources and their very conservative or very sort of middle-of-the-ground politics begin to shape what sort of LGBT politics would become. So that by the time we get to 1992, when Bill Clinton is in power, that segment of the movement had already taken hold and had latched itself onto the Democratic Party in a particular way, and that's how we even get to dropping the ban on gays serving as a military as the first presidential sort of promise to a sort of new gay constituent. And so that becomes the real moment at which we see a shift in queer politics and a real beginning sort of divide where that the kind of mainstream movement really now has a seat at the table within Democratic capital D politics, and all of the issues that it begins to kind of orient itself around, don't ask, don't tell, marriage equality, reflect that sort of image. And in fact, a lot of, even if now when you look at a lot of the sort of arguments about marriage equality, the different, you know, people, different organizations put forward, Lisa Dugan raises this in her piece about the marriage equality movement in A New Queer Agenda, that they use this language about the gay community being kind of trapped in a constant state of adolescence, right? So that to be an actual sort of adult, you know, means that you, like, not having the ability to get married traps the community into some perpetual state of, like, childhood, right? And that's also very kind of Moynihan reportish when you look at, you know, how that report talked about black communities and marriage and the lack of marriage, you know, in the African American community as a kind of infantilizing process. And so it's a really, really dangerous slope that people use to discuss. And so I think it's really that a lot of it kind of becomes more and more pronounced at the onset of the AIDS epidemic, you know, these arguments about why we need marriage equality to curb some of the sexual and cultural excesses of the gay community, and that we are trapped in a permanent state of adolescence until we can win that right.
You alluded to this, but this is something I think needs to be brought out, and it's true of a lot of political movements, the role of funders in setting agendas. Do you want to talk about that?
Oh, God. Sure. I think that, you know, political movements are built by the engagement of a community, but they're also sustained often by their ability to have some kind of resource, financial resource that they can depend on so that they are not completely driven by volunteer effort, and especially if they're not mass movements. And so as the kind of all the different political movements that came out of the 60s and 70s began to grow into these more established forms of organizations, they more and more depended on private funding, because it certainly wasn't coming from the government, certainly not for the LGBT community. And there are very few funders that fund LGBT exclusively, and there are a few beyond that that fund a tiny segment of the LGBT agenda. But they often set that agenda by how they fund. So if you need money, but, you know, I have to tell you that in the way that HIV actually served as a funding stream for the building of a queer movement, ironically, the marriage equality movement has played the same role. It's been an enormous kind of pool of money that gave resource to struggling LGBT organizations. But the result of that funding was that you had to prioritize that agenda in the way that you did all your other political work. So funders and the question of funding have been really critical and problematic for many political movements, and the LGBT community is really trapped in that. QEJ has a radical agenda, doesn't pretend that we step back from that vision and those priorities. And I think it does impact where it is we can look for money and what it is that we have to argue we're doing in order to have credibility in the funding world. Kenyon, you said in your piece in New Queer Agenda that that the question of deliverables, the question of how funders mark and expect result, means that in scrappy movements, you're held accountable, but in these larger LGBT movement fundraising, it's not like marriage equality won, but they got more and more money from more and more people and more institutions. There's a different set of values for equality than there is for liberation.
That was Amber Hollibaugh, co-director of Queers for Economic Justice, and we're about to hear from Kenyon Farrow, the former executive director of that organization. Both are contributors to The New Queer Agenda, a special issue of The Scholar and Feminist Online, a publication of Barnard College.
Yeah, just to piggyback off of that, I mean, Amber just raised a good point. I mean, when you look at, even if you argue from a kind of empirical perspective on philanthropy, and you say, okay, so if we look at the kind of the marriage equality movement, and if we look at the work that those equality organizations have done to either, you know, get marriage equality passed at the state level, which has clearly been a strategy, or to at least fight back, the different ballot initiatives to ban same-sex marriage, you know, in various state constitutions, which has happened over the last 8 years. If you look at that as a barometer, it's actually been a colossal failure, right? In the last 8 years, we actually have worse legal conditions for LGBT families and actually in a lot of unmarried straight families as a byproduct.
Yeah, right.
In the way that most of these things were written, that gutted protections for, sort of common law marriages, as they're often known, you know, at the state level for straight people. So it's actually been a colossal policy failure, and yet they continue to granted, you know, hundreds of thousands and in some cases seven figures from foundations. And I think what we kind of increasingly need to be worried about when we look at what happened here in New York State to win marriage equality, where you had this coming together of LGBT equality organizations with the both the Democratic and the state legislature, and then with right-wing funders, like individual donors who, you know, work for, raise money for Tea Party organizations and through, you know, and some of which are hedge fund managers, raised money to protect four, you know, Republican legislators in the state so that they would vote for marriage equality to sort of tip the scale in favor of it and so that they would have funding to be backed in case that there was a Republican challenge in their districts. So now
that was an explicit commitment that was made to those four Republican legislators, is that
right.
They would not suffer financially if they took the chance to vote for queer marriage, that they would not then suffer defeat or financial withdrawal of funding because Democrats and queer wealthy people would step in to fund their campaigns.
Yeah, and so now you have this, one of those donors has actually just last week announced that he's starting a super PAC, a Republican GOP super PAC for LGBT rights, right? So it tells you something that the landscape has really shifted even further to the right, so that now the strategy will be to continue to raise money for Republican candidates who, you know, would not support any kind of progressive agenda on any other, you know, issue, but will be, you know, sort of developed and worked with through the lens of marriage equality. And once we have even more of the, you know, human rights campaign and a number of other, like, statewide equality organizations working more closely in cahoots with Republican legislatures and also donors, we have a real serious problem, you know, and what that means in terms of queer politics moving forward.
Which brings me to my next question. Why should economic justice be part of a queer agenda? Amber?
Well, there isn't any question but that the way that you experience queer identity is embedded in the way you can live your life. If I'm homeless, I have the same desires to sleep with who I want to sleep with, but I may not have the physical space to sleep with somebody in the way that I might if I had my own apartment and I could lock a door. It is a different kind of reality to be poor and to be queer and to be trans and to be vulnerable to the possibility of being employed. All of these kinds of issues play out around identity in very particular ways because your identity is embedded in many things, not just one thing. You're not just gay, like a star circling the sun.
To which I could imagine someone saying, well, you know, we have organizations for poor people, we have organizations for homeless people, why can't I have just my queer organization?
Well, it's not yours. An organization has to reflect a community. Otherwise, it's simply an individual's perspective. If you're reflecting a community, you have to ask what community you're reflecting. And if the majority of LGBTQ people are actually not in wealthy communities, then you're not reflecting the majority of queer people's experiences when you build a political agenda. So if I'm sitting at QEJ and the issue is either marriage equality or universal health care, frankly, I need universal health care a whole lot more than I need marriage equality. And that's what I'm going to prioritize. That's what I'm going to talk about. The stop and frisk work has a huge dimension that's LGBT because of the way that in communities of color, people are patted down in vulnerable communities, and they're often trans and gender nonconforming. That's the overlapping piece that happens again and again. An economic agenda isn't theoretical. It's the lived reality of the majority of us that are queer. If I can be fired because I'm queer and I'm poor and I can't afford to lose a job, I'm vulnerable in a very different way than if I can go home and get a check from my dad.
Right. As Amber was talking about the stop and frisk laws here in New York City and the kind of career impact, I think one of the things that's been most frustrating, and this is expressed in a lot of the mass media that we see, so that a lot of the media has reported, you know, kind of, oh, my God, the blacks and the gays are now working together on the stop and frisk issue. And a lot of the sort of stories act as though the sort of LGBT, this is not an LGBT issue, right? This is an act of generosity from, you know, LGBT equality organizations who may in fact see it as such, right? But right. What's been really striking to me is organizations like QEJ, like Audre Lorde Project, Sue Rivera Law Project, Fierce, you know, have been working around the kind of criminalization of like poor and low income and black and brown, you know, queer and trans folks in New York City for a decade solid, right? And, you know, so that the stop, so like if you go to Christopher Street, right, and the Christopher Street piers, for the last 10 years, there have been four different policing entities that police a 10-block radius. And they only police the part of the West Village where the black and brown queer folks, you know, hang out. So from Christopher Street and, say, 7th Avenue down to the piers. They're not policing NYU students, right, on the other part of the village. So to me, this is representative of how sort of poorly constructed notions of kind of queer issues are in mainstream LGBT organizations, but also been moved through the popular kind of mainstream press. So the fact that none of those organizations who are going to be present at the march here in New York City on Sunday, you know, around Stop and Frisk, were quoted or even their work was referenced as the organizations that have been doing this work in New York City. You know, and in fact, quite frankly, you could very easily argue that that an LGBT movement exists at all because of policing, right? The original sort of, you know, kind of construction of queer liberation was around relationships with the police, vis-a-vis, right, the Stonewall Rebellion. The fact that the actual idea of a queer activism arises out of, like, police brutality and targeting. So to me, like, the issue of why an economic justice and a racial justice framework is really important right now, because then we end up, even where there is some now press coverage around stop and frisk and kind of LGBT organizations involved, it's been constructed in this way that it makes the assumption that actually this isn't impacting queer people, right, versus if we were operating from a kind of racial justice and economic justice lens, that would already be the assumption, and so the groups that have been doing that work for the longest period of time, not the Johnny-come-latelys, would have been central to those news stories and the conversation.
And finally, we're just about out of time, but the struggle for the seat at the table, or, you know, to be perceived as straight in just every detail but one, has kind of suppressed the queer side, the desire side of the agenda. So, Amber, you have a piece about desire in this issue. Talk about what's happened to that in this mainstreaming.
Well, in the mainstreaming, it's, you know, it isn't an accident that marriage couples with being normal. You want to be normal, you want to get married, you want to, et cetera. There are a whole range of things that come with the idea of being normal. Gay liberation was never based on being normal. It was based on shifting the way that people understood themselves, their bodies, their desires, their hopes, so that there was a different vision for how it is that you were a sexual person and you engaged in sex and freedom. And a liberation, I just think, you know, sexuality too often gets dropped from the way we envision a political movement. Too often we're afraid of it, or we only talk about it in the context of something that's risky, like reproductive health or HIV status. We don't talk about how it is that desire embeds itself in the possibility of a transformed world, of feeling your body, living in your body, having the possibility of desire gives you hope. in a way that can't be reduced to something that's small and singular. And a movement that wants to fight for its own liberation but give up sex as the price of being normal, which is, in my mind, what the equality movement has done for LGBT people, is a movement that has no vision, has no erotics, has no heat. And frankly, you can go on a march, but when you leave that march, you've got to have, I think, the possibility of building a different kind of world, and desire is profoundly a part of the way that a political agenda, an economic recession, the way that you live a queer identity has to be spoken of. It has to be owned by the people who are most disenfranchised, and that means sex has to be at the core, not at the edge, of the dialogue about change.
Those were Amber Hollibaugh and Kenyon Farrow, contributors to an online journal issue called The New Queer Agenda. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Lesbians and Ecstasy's song Revolt. Till next week, bye.